May it please the Court. The issue presented by this appeal is a fundamental one. Is there going to be judicial review in Delaware of alternative entity conflict transactions? It's hard to imagine a more troubling set of facts. A minority squeeze out at a double-digit discount, an opening counteroffer by the negotiating committee for the minority just 4% above the controller's opening offer, representing a dollar discount to the value of that offer when made. The committee's banker disclaims any role in the negotiations, and in the run-up to the opening offer by the controller makes a series of statements that turn out not to be true and that had a clear, demonstrable, value-destructive effect.
On the letter, are you talking about statements in the proxy?
The statements, Your Honor, that precede the date of the proxy. Okay. Specifically,
the press releases?
They were, I think in one case it was an 8K and may well have been an accompanying press release. And in another case, yes, it was a press release announcing the financial results for the first quarter of the year. Okay. And the nature of those statements, again, were first, an announcement upon the consummation of the acquisition of the company by Vanguard that we look forward to managing these assets for the long-term benefit of unit holders, and then subsequent statements predicting that production was going to decline. It ultimately didn't, and announcing that they were going to more than triple capital expenditures, reducing distributions from the partnership, obviously a key driver of value in the case of these entities, to the lowest level that the partnership had had since its inception years earlier. If this set of facts doesn't get past a motion to dismiss, I submit none ever will. And there are good reasons why this kind of transaction should be subject to judicial review and why this court shouldn't immunize transactions like this. First, from an institutional perspective, Delaware courts just shouldn't be approving sham transactions or sham processes like the negotiating committee process here. Independent committees have real value, and Delaware courts have recognized that repeatedly. And if we have a regime where their actions are not subject to any review, what that is going to do is provide a strong incentive for controllers in every case to appoint accommodationists who are happy to take their fees and happy to provide their blessing and do nothing more.
Well, the response to that, you know, based on the opinion of the trial judge and, you know, predictably from the other side, is that the limited partners went into this deal, this relationship, with their eyes open and fully aware that there were very limited protections afforded by the limited partnership agreement. And as a consequence, there was no guarantee, or even there shouldn't have been any expectation, that they would necessarily be treated fairly in the event of a fundamental transaction like the one at issue here.
Respectfully, Justice Jacobs, I think any reading of the partnership agreement would contradict Your Honor's statement of a moment ago. The proposition that there are limited protections here is, I respectfully submit, just not right. There's clearly less protection than in the corporate context, no question about that. But if one looks at what the protections are in the limited partnership agreement, and we maintain the assumption that, in fact, public entity investors are, in fact, parsing the full detail in the limited partnership agreement.
Well, we're not talking great grand policy here. We're talking about this transaction as measured by whatever criteria or duties are created by this limited partnership agreement.
Point taken, Your Honor. And so let's look at those specific duties that are imposed. There's a section 7.9, in the limited partnership agreement that addresses conflict transactions. And it provides a variety of mechanisms.
Right, there are really two layers of insulation that this agreement tries to create to insulate a transaction and the general partner from judicial review. One of them is the safe harbors, including and in particular the special approval safe harbor, which if it's followed would not result in any breach of contract or any breach of duty at all by its own terms. And secondly, to the extent that one can penetrate that layer of protection, there's a second layer of protection afforded by the conclusive presumption, which says that in a transaction like this, if the general partner relies on an opinion of an investment bank or other expert as to matters which the general partner reasonably believes the expert is qualified, then there's a conclusive presumption of good faith. Now, how do we deal with that?
Well, I hear Your Honor breaking it up into two parts and assuming that if the if a conflict transaction gets past the protections of Section 7.9, then the general partner is allowed to resort to 7.10. And I'd suggest that reading the two together is not warranted under the language of the limited partnership agreement.
Yeah, but how do we get there?
So,
is your argument that turning to 7.9, the safe harbor, that even the safe harbor is not immune from judicial review in terms of whether or not it was employed in good faith?
Correct.
Let's stop there. But then you've got the problem of the conclusive presumption of good faith from 7.10.
Well, Your Honor, only if the court concludes that 7.10 applies to conflict transactions and applies beyond its clear terms to parties other than the general partner. That is to say, explicitly 7.10 speaks only to the general partner.
Right.
And the directors and the controller, Vanguard, are manifestly not the general partner. So by its clear terms, that language doesn't apply. But you would also need to evaluate whether the conclusive presumption that's provided actually applies here. And it doesn't for a couple of reasons. One, that the fairness opinion is premised on facts that are simply not true and are alleged in detail not to be true in the complaint. It relies on...
Well, but that's not an argument that the conclusive presumption is so narrowly worded that it doesn't sweep up this transaction. It does. You're saying that there's something flawed about the opinion that makes it unreliable?
Correct, and it simply doesn't speak to the issues that are presented by the conduct here, which is a failure to negotiate on the part of the conflicts committee.
Can you explain to me precisely what is the relationship between 7.9 and 7.10? And by that I mean there are apparently unquestioned independent directors who sit for special approval purposes in this conflicted transaction. They are not the general partner. So the link between the conclusive presumption and the general partner arguably does not affect them. They begin with the prospect of a rebuttable presumption, but they go forward and seek the expertise of an investment banker who is qualified, I think, based on the papers I've read. What is the distinction between the rebuttable presumption, the use of the investment banker, which is not required in order to trigger the rebuttable presumption under the conflict provision, and the general partner and the relationship to the conclusive presumption?
So a couple of points, Chief Justice. First is, as we argue in the papers, 7.10 and the conclusive presumption should not be construed to apply at all to conflict transactions, which have their own mechanism and framework in 7.9 and are more specific, and the more specific provisions in 7.9 should trump the more general in 7.10. The other thing is that if one looks at 7.10 in its entirety, the conclusive presumption is one part of a broader set of provisions that are talking to what the general partner does in the discharge of the business of the partnership in the ordinary course. And 710A at A 085 of the appendix talks about relying on resolutions, certificates, and statements. It makes good sense to have provisions that provide protection for the general partner outside of the conflict arena, where it's simply discharging the general duties of a general partner in the ordinary course. And it makes sense to have more acute protections for public unit holders in the case of a conflict transaction where the general partner can't be relied on to be acting in the mutual interests of all of the equity holders of the entity.
Okay.
And if I may, coming back to Justice Jacobs' point about limited protections, there's a framework here, as Your Honor rightly noted, under 7.9, safe harbor, that provides these various mechanisms for cleansing a conflict transaction. And so special approval is one of those. But to understand what special approval would reasonably be construed to mean for a unit holder investing here who read this document in detail, it's in the context of approval by a majority of the minority or a majority of the unaffiliated unit holders.
Well, those are the alternative safe harbors.
Yes, Your Honor, and my point is those alternatives are instructive with respect to what special approval should look like.
Yeah, well, the trial court agreed with you, except that he concluded since the special approval process was not either alternatives 2, 3, or 4, that it showed that there could have been no reasonable expectation on the part of the unit holders that the special approval process would have any of the elements of those other three alternatives.
Well, I think the case ultimately does turn on the issue of what this conflicts committee, this ostensibly independent committee, was required to do or not do when presented with this conflict transaction. And the answer is what this conflicts committee was expected to do was look hard at the terms and bargain in a good faith way, and good faith here meaning not act passively, not act as a rubber stamp, not simply go through the motions. And you get there whether you apply traditional fiduciary principles, which the limited partnership agreement preserves as a gap filler, or if you just take a step back and look at this in a real simple-minded way, what would somebody reasonably believe looking at this contract? The conclusion would be that I'm going to have some independent guys looking at this deal and working on my
behalf
to make sure it's fair.
You're saying that the unit holders would have the exact opposite expectation reading Section 7.9 in connection with how the special approval process would be implemented. That is the exact opposite of what the Court of Chancery found.
Forgive me, Your Honor.
Let's back up for a minute. My difficulty is this is a transaction that the validity of which is being determined on the basis of a partnership agreement that has many moving parts. And it's not clear how these parts fit together and how we're supposed to relate this transaction to those parts. I think it would be helpful if you could identify what issues we need to decide in order to get to the result that you contend the law requires us to reach.
Yes, Your Honor, and let me do my best. We start with Section 7.9, which is addressed to transactions such as the one before us today a conflict transaction. And the general partner invoked one of the available mechanisms, the special approval process, using the conflicts committee.
Why doesn't that end the case?
Because there's a requirement of good faith in the conflict committee's conduct of its evaluation of the transaction.
Where do we find the definition of good faith? As I read the Vice Chancellor's opinion, he suggests that the standard comes from this contract. The definition of good faith is a subjective good faith, that they did not believe themselves that they were acting in bad faith, so to speak, that they were doing what they were supposed to be doing. They were doing that with which they were charged by the partnership agreement. I ask you this because you made a comment about gap filling. I read this agreement to say traditional fiduciary duties were eliminated. And if one wants to look to the duties of the managers or the fiduciaries, the contractual parties here, consistent with freedom of contract, you look to the words of the contract itself. You don't look beyond it. There are no gaps to fill. Why is that wrong? Why are we limited to, why do we involve with anything more than how the Vice Chancellor defined good faith in connection with the special approval process?
So two answers. First, under Section 7.9E, which is the provision that eliminates fiduciary principles generally, it says we eliminate fiduciary principles only to the extent inconsistent with the language here. And my second response is that whether one applies fiduciary principles or simply applies contract principles to answer a question not answered by the express language of the agreement, you get to the same result. And that is, we have a definition of good faith. Good faith is defined as the best interests of the partnership. And what the limited partnership nowhere does is say, what does an individual acting in good faith do presented with a conflict transaction that he or she has been charged to address? That issue, the very issue before the court, is simply nowhere addressed in the limited partnership agreement. And the resulting conclusion that the independent director on the conflicts committee doesn't have to do anything at all surely is not right. We need to look somewhere for a source for an answer to Your Honor's question. What does a conflicts committee member do when presented with a conflict transaction? And I'd suggest that the answer is that they look seriously at the offered deal.
My understanding from your answer is that the contract requires that the general partner carry out the special approval process in good faith. Then the question is, okay, what is good faith? And that's the Chief Justice's question.
And my answer,
the trial court dealt with that. Adopted a definition. Is it your contention that that definition is right or wrong?
The proposition is that the analysis of the trial court was very wrong.
Why?
Because it defined good faith inverted as the absence of bad faith, and thereby defined good faith to mean simply the absence of malice. And what this court's jurisprudence has held repeatedly is that good faith includes conscious disregard for responsibilities, and what we have here is a set of facts that strongly supports the conclusion that the conflicts committee here acted as a rubber stamp.
And right, so number one, we have to decide where the contract doesn't define good faith. We have to determine what the default definition is and whether the court got it right. And secondly, we then need to determine whether, based on that definition, the special approval process passes muster. That is, was conducted in good faith, however defined. Correct?
Correct.
How can that be correct? You just told us that good faith was action in the best interest of the partnership, as the contract defines it. And the vice chancellor said that's a subjective analysis, and your complaint shows no well-pleaded facts that the special approval process, the people involved in the special approval process, subjectively believed that they were not acting in the best interest of the partnership.
And, Chief Justice, it would be a reversal of this court's precedent to hold that at the pleading stage, a plaintiff is required to establish a subjective belief, which is clearly within the minds of the individuals and will never be within the domain of the plaintiff. So the consequence of holding that here is to immunize this and every similar transaction from judicial review. And I'd suggest even at the trial stage, what Your Honor just articulated is not the right standard, because we always, always view objective evidence as an indication of subjective belief because of the inherent difficulties, even at trial, of establishing what was in someone's mind.
Well, how far do we go with that? Does that mean that whenever subjective good faith is at issue, there's always going to be a trial because the chancellor is going to have to look the witness in the eye and decide whether he's telling the truth?
Justice Ridgely, I think the answer is that you need to look at the allegations on the face of the well-pleaded complaint and determine whether they offer a credible basis to believe that there was subjective bad faith here. And a take-under in a minority squeeze-out context with a 10% discount to the pre-existing unaffected trading price, a counteroffer well below the median of the advisor's own valuation analysis, that's a 4% bump and less in a dollar value, is a pretty shocking set of facts and raises at the least a serious question as to what were these people subjectively thinking, and did they really think in accepting a deal that was going to destroy value for the public unit holders here and impair their distributions going forward, did they really think that was in the best interest of those public unit holders or the partnership?
Now, you're down to 2 minutes for your rebuttal. Did you want to save that time?
If I may.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Before I begin my remarks, let me just say that it's always a pleasure to be, it's a real privilege to be in the courts of Delaware. This is my first time in the Delaware Supreme Court, and it's a unique privilege to be here. With all due respect to opposing counsel, there's much that we disagree with respect to how this contract works, how it should be construed, the definitions in it, and his allegations.
Do you agree, however, on what the issues are?
If properly framed, I think I agree that the issue is, did the defendants, and in particular the Conflicts Committee, because a Conflicts Committee was appointed, did that process meet the terms of the agreement? And at the same time, has plaintiff pled allegations to show that this Conflicts Committee acted in subjective bad faith? That is the requirement of the agreement. The one thing that opposing counsel just referenced was the definition of what good faith is under the contract. And under the limited partnership agreement, it is very clear, and it's in 7.9b, the last sentence, and it applies for all good faith determinations under the limited partnership agreement. In order for a determination or other action to be in good faith for purposes of this agreement, the person or persons making such determination or taking or declining to take such action must believe that the determination or other action is in the best interest of the partnership. Person or persons is a defined term under the contract that would include all of the defendants.
Let's stop there for a moment, because I have a question. The Vice Chancellor focused on that language and drew two conclusions from it. The first was that language connotes or denotes a purely subjective belief. that the action is in the best interest of the partnership. Second, the court went further and, based on a pronouncement in some other case, said that the true meaning of good faith, or at least the requirement of proof of bad faith, is that the party claiming bad faith has to show that the general partner or whoever the defendant is subjectively believed that the action would be against the best interest of the partnership. That's a twist that isn't in the language of the agreement itself, and it makes a difference, at least on a motion to dismiss, because without the twist, it might be sufficient to allege facts that simply create a litigatable question as to whether the general partner believed that the action was in the best interest of the partnership. Whereas with the twist, the pled facts have to show affirmatively that the general partner actually believed that what it was doing was not in the best interest, a much more difficult burden. I note that in your brief, you don't adopt the twist that the Court of Chancery put on it. You seem to adhere, you and the, you know, your clients adhere to the actual language of the agreement. Is that correct?
Well, let me answer the first part of the question first, and then I'll get to the second part, which is going to be a much longer answer. I think the first question
is a long question.
It's pretty simple. With respect to it being a subjective belief, I think using the word believe in that paragraph is a subjective belief. It doesn't say reasonably believe. You look at other MLP agreements, particularly some of the other MLP agreements before the court, and you're going to see different formulations. Sometimes no formulation is what good faith means. In this agreement, it says believe, and I think our position is that is a subjective standard, and that is what the drafters meant. Okay, moving to the next question about the relationship between this good faith definition and bad faith is, when you look at that sentence and that sentence alone, there's no bad faith concept in that sentence. But there is a bad faith concept that is relevant to this case, because this is a money damages case provided elsewhere in Article 7. And let me take a step back. The provisions we're talking about appear in Article 7 of the partnership agreement. That governs the
To focus the question, yeah. The court put a gloss on the actual language of the agreement. Do you agree with that gloss? And if so, what's the basis for imposing it?
The basis would be found in Section 77A, which says that all of the defendants in this case are exculpated in a money damages case for all conduct other than bad faith conduct. Plaintiff's only claim here is a bad faith claim. So when you put those concepts together, here you have a good faith concept in 7.8b.
Yeah, but how does the word bad faith in the exculpation clause get you to the gloss that the court added to the actual contract language?
Well, I guess I don't view the court's gloss as adding it to 7.8b. I view it as looking at, in a money damages case, looking at 7.7a, where it says there can be the limited partners agree in this from the beginning. There would be no money damages against any of the officers and directors, any the general partner, any of its affiliates, unless they acted in bad faith. Now, bad faith is not a defined term in the contract. There is no definition for it. So when I look at this contract and I say, well, how does good faith and bad faith work? I think they're coterminous. I think if you're acting in bad faith, you have to show you acted against the interest of the partnership. If good faith in the contract is you must believe you're acting in the best interest of the partnership, then bad faith must be the opposite.
Well, what about a conscious disregard of the interests of the partnership?
It's our position that that is excluded by the definition of good faith in the contract, which is a belief in the best.
If you don't consider the interests of the partnership, how can you believe it's in the best interest of the partnership?
Okay, so if you had allegations, which we don't have, I think, in this case that get there, but if you had the kind of allegations where it's the conflicts committee didn't consider anything, they didn't even meet, they didn't do anything, then yes, I think it would be hard to say you acted in good, you believed in that it was in the best interest of the partnership. To me, they couldn't have believed that it was in the best interest, or they didn't believe it was in the best interest because they didn't consider anything. They didn't even make a decision. So that is a situation where they didn't believe that it would be in the best interest. I don't think anything short of showing that the conflicts committee did not believe it was in the best interest will work. And I would like to make one other point, if I may, on this, is when you look at special approval, and I think is rightly noted, when you look at 7.9a, which addresses conflicts committee or addresses conflicts transactions, and what it says is if you follow one of these four alternatives, special approval being one of them, it's deemed approved by all partners. You then go to the definition of special approval, and it requires majority approval by the conflicts committee acting in good faith. There's that defined term. It goes further and says if you get special approval, the conflicts committee is presumed to have acted in good faith. So right from the beginning, you are presumed, the conflicts committee is presumed to have subjectively believed that this transaction was in good faith.
Now that's rebuttable, though, right?
It is rebuttable. I agree. It is rebuttable. And it says that the plaintiff has the burden, the limited partner bringing a suit has a burden. So that language must mean something. And at the pleading stage, what I would submit that it means is that the plaintiff must come forward and show that there was no basis on which this conflicts committee could have subjectively believed that this transaction was in the best interest of the partnership. And I think the allegations in this case fall far short.
Well, I had asked you, what the basis in the contract was for the gloss that the court appended to the actual contract language. And you pointed to a provision in the exculpation clause, and I think made an elegant argument that put the two together. I don't recall seeing that reasoning, however elegant, in the court's opinion, nor do I recall seeing it in your brief. And so I ask again, on what basis can the court take the actual language defining good faith and burden it with a requirement to show affirmative belief that the transaction was not in the best interest, as opposed to simply creating a litigable issue as to whether or not there was a sincere belief?
What I would submit respectfully is that when you look at, so the court did rely on the Atlas Energy case, which had a very similar MLP agreement. And also the agreement in this case, and I think the court is, when you look at Atlas Energy and look at this case, the court was aware and knew that you have an exculpation. And it's not 7.7a, by the way, it's 7.8a. I apologize for that, but 7.8a, when you have that, and it was, we did argue that in the Court of Chancery, that you do have that exculpation for money damages, because that's all we're dealing with at this point is a money damages case. I think, to me, I don't see it as a gloss on 7.8b, respectfully. I see it as harmonizing 7.8a and 7.9b, the bad faith and the good faith. In a money damages case, those are going to have to be harmonized. With respect to whether it was in our brief, it's our position that if you look at the allegations and what the plaintiff has not contested in this case, that you don't need to go so far as to say, well, have they pled facts that could conceivably show bad faith? It's my position they haven't even shown facts that conceivably show, put the presumption aside, not even looking at the presumption, they haven't even pled facts that could conceivably show that there was no good faith as that's defined by the contract. The plaintiff has admitted in this case, and this is not from the proxy, this is from statements made in the brief, statements made at oral argument, brief in the Chancery Court, an oral argument, and statements made here. This conflicts committee was properly formed. It was independent. The plaintiff uses the word qualified businessmen on this conflicts committee. It was given, plaintiff's words, a broad delegation of authority that included the authority to review, study, negotiate this transaction or any alternative to the transaction. The plaintiff doesn't dispute that the conflicts committee hired qualified and independent legal counsel, hired the Bracewell firm, and as well as Richards, Leighton, and Finger, does not dispute that the Conflicts Committee hired Jeffries. And one important point about Jeffries is that at oral argument in the Chancery Court, plaintiff counsel said, we don't dispute that Jeffries was qualified. In fact, let me read you the exact quote. Your Honor, there are two distinct claims at issue here. Plaintiffs could have argued that the price is unfair and Jeffries was incompetent and that there was no basis for relying on the Jeffries analysis. That's not at all what plaintiffs argue. What we take issue with is the course of conduct adopted by the Conflicts Committee and the fact that where they ended up was within a range of fair value, within a range of fair value. But that doesn't answer the proposition that they were ineffective and not in good faith bargaining agents. So qualified investment bankers.
Well, your argument is that the conclusive presumption provision, which was followed here, that is, which applies because there was no dispute about Jeffrey's qualifications, basically shuts the door to all inquiry about good faith, which is now conclusively presumed. That said, there's no that removes any basis to argue that there was a flaw in the implementation of the special approval process, and therefore no duty could have been violated because there's no claim can be raised. Is that your position?
That is a separate position, but I'm not to that point yet. I'm only focused on 7-9A right now, not even looking at the conclusive presumption.
I hope you make that clear because I have never read the basis for your perspective to be that you were relying on the conclusive presumption from 7-10 that applies to the general partner. I thought you were relying on 7-9 and the actions that have been criticized under the special approval process and the independent directors that served on the Conflicts Committee.
Yes, to be very clear, it is our position that the plaintiff has failed to plead a claim under 7-9A of the partnership agreement, which is the provision that is applicable here. The plaintiff's argument that there are traditional fiduciary duties and things that kind of carry along, I think, is completely incorrect. I think you can look at 7-9A, 7-9B, 7-9E, all of which make clear that the traditional fiduciary duties are gone and the only duties that we are talking about are the duties that are in this contract, right? And, of course, you have the implied covenant, but they do not make, as they say in their reply brief, they are not making an implied covenant claim, so we don't have to get into a discussion on implied covenant. But separately, okay, so I don't think it's our position, they don't plead a claim under 7-9A. My recitation of what is not contested, I think, goes to this notion of whether they have pled a claim that these individuals on the committee did not act in good faith, and then on top of that, whether in light of these uncontested facts for purposes of the pleadings, and they are uncontested, whether that could ever get over the presumption. And I think, sure, you never want to say never, but in light of plaintiff says this is a sham process, this wasn't a sham process. You had a very, as they admit, qualified.
Well, just to follow up on the Chief Justice's question, do I correctly understand that you do not rely on Section 710, the conclusive presumption provision, as a defense? That is, it's not necessary to the arguments that you're making to your position.
It is not necessary to 7-9A. We do rely on it in the alternative. Okay? So I don't think you even need to get to 7-10B in the conclusive presumption in this case, but I think if the court concluded they have pled a claim under 7-9A, then I do think the conclusive presumption steps in at that point. But I don't think you even get past 7-9A in this case. And only if you get past 7-9A do you have to deal with 7-10B.
Okay, if I've understood you correctly, it seems as if you're also pushing aside, if you will, the whole question of how you define good faith, because I think I hear you saying that if the special committee was properly designated in terms of who was on it, and if they got the proper qualified advisors, and they then had a meeting, that's it. You really can't attack it anymore, and you can't say they didn't act in good faith because they did all the things that they were supposed to do.
If that's the implication that I gave, I apologize. That's not the definition of good faith. Our position is squarely in the contract 7-8B. which says good faith is a subjective belief. My argument about all the things that they did goes with, which is uncontested in the plaintiff saying this is, the allegations show that it's a sham process. The allegations don't show that, and they've admitted otherwise. That, to me, in looking at whether there is a conceivable set of facts under which they could recover, show subjective good faith, when you look or show that they didn't act in subjective good faith, those facts go in to that analysis at the pleading stage. And particularly here, where you have a contractual presumption of good faith, this lawsuit does not start on equal footing. The conflicts committee is presumed, and it is rebuttable, but is presumed to have acted in the belief that they were doing the right thing for this partnership. And the plaintiff must come forward with allegations that overcome that presumption. Now,
is the good faith language here, especially considering we're talking about independent directors, is that the equivalent of the business judgment rule?
I don't want to say it's the equivalent because, of course, the contract excludes fiduciary duties, but I certainly think it's akin. It could be, you can think of it, and I can tell you in reading these MLP agreements and looking at the presumptions in here, yeah, I think that you start, as in a business judgment context, you don't start at a level playing field when the suit is filed. There is a presumption in favor, and in this case, contractually mandated in favor of this conflicts committee. So I don't think it is the business judgment rule, but
It does conjure up, does it not, in the minds of a judicial officer, that on what basis does a judicial officer second-guess the business decision that was made by the conflicts committee in the special approval process in light of what we know on the facts, which are uncontested, about their mode of operation?
Yes, I think that's correct. I think the business judgment rule, when you're talking about is it rational or not, obviously rational is not in this contract. What is in the contract is belief. And so for a judicial review, and I don't agree that the contract forecloses all judicial review. I think by its plain terms, it sets forth clear rights and obligations and duties that you can come in and talk about. One of them is subjective good faith. And so I think when you're looking back, a judicial officer can look back and say, okay, you have this presumption of good faith. Now, what are the allegations here, and are those allegations enough to overcome that presumption?
But if you add to the mix the conclusive presumption of Section 710, then it does shut the door to all judicial review, doesn't it?
Well, if you meet the conclusive presumption, the conclusive presumption has four elements.
Let's assume you need the conclusive presumption.
If you meet the conclusive presumption, then yes, I think the conclusive presumption by its terms says that you are conclusively presumed to have acted in good faith. And let me address a couple of arguments on that were made. One, this notion that it's in 710 versus 7-9. Article 7, I think that parses it too finely. Article 7 applies to the management of the partnership and places that management squarely in the hands of the GP. If you look at 7-1, it says the GP is authorized to do a host of things. Okay, it doesn't say anybody else other than the GP. Then you look through Article 7, there's all sorts of things that the GP is authorized to do. 7-9 addresses conflicts of interest transaction. And then 7-10 says other matters. When you look at 710B on its face, it applies to any decision of the GP, conflicted, unconflicted, and there's no basis to read in any kind of distinction. Now, with respect to the argument that it only says the GP, I think the issue I have with that argument is that the GP, so that 710B says that the GP must select, must rely on it, must select an investment banker or other expert, must rely on the opinion, and must reasonably believe that that opinion is within that expert's expertise. Within the professional, it says professional or expert competence. None of those elements, it's not disputed that Jeffries was retained, not disputed in this case, gave an opinion, a fairness opinion, although they quibble with some of the disclaimers.
I was just asking about the architecture of the agreement as a conceptual matter so that we can understand
okay.
it.
Okay. So, my point about saying that is, it is the conflicts committee that did the selecting. It is the conflicts committee that did the relying. It is the conflicts committee that did the reasonably believing. It would be, seem to me, to result in an odd situation if the GP gets this conclusive presumption, but the people who gave the GP the conclusive presumption don't get the benefit of it. Or you could say it in a couple of different ways. The GP is ultimately the legal entity sitting at the switch that causes this transaction to happen.
If that's the case, if the individuals that are part of the governing body of the GP get the benefit of the presumption, as you argue, then aren't they also subject to the burden of having to act in good faith and subject to a claim of liability that they didn't, just like the GP? I mean, isn't it a two-way street?
Well, okay, one, I think the contract does say that you must act in good faith, and nobody in this contract has any liabilities other than those set forth therein. I think you may have some argument about, well, if you only have a claim for breach of contract, who are the parties to the contract? We haven't asserted that, so that's a couple of steps down the way. But I definitely think that this agreement sets forth, as I said, the rights and obligations of not only the GP, okay, and well, really of the GP. And it said, when you look at either it says the GP or in 7.8b, the person or persons making the decision on behalf of the GP must act in good faith. But I think you have an argument about, well, can you be sued for a contract that you're not a party to? I think that's a separate argument that question implicates.
What is your response to Desert Equities and the language in there that state of mind may be pledged?
Okay. First of all, I think saying that you can just, and as I interpret the plaintiff's argument, it is all you have to say is bad faith. Say, if we say bad faith, that's all you have to allege. And I don't think that squares with this court's other precedent that says you can disregard conclusory allegations, which I would say bad faith is the ultimate question. So that would be a legal allegation, unless they are supported by well-pled allegations. In this case, just saying, okay, in paragraph 79, they acted in bad faith, that's not enough. And I think in Desert Equities, the other difference here is that we have a different limited partnership agreement that has different standards. One of those is this presumption of good faith that we've been talking about. And so just saying bad faith, just saying bad faith doesn't get over that presumption. You have to do more than that. And so for that reason, I think Desert Equities also doesn't apply. But I think
So the presumption that is a substantive presumption that arises out of the agreement, Section 7.9, I think you said.
7.9A.
Also imports an obligation to plead with particularity facts that would indicate the absence of good faith.
I think that sets forth the substantive standard, gives a presumption, and so, yes, you do have to plead facts. But I think that's the second reason. The first reason is I think you have to do more than simply just say, use the magic words bad faith, and voila, we have a bad faith claim. You have to set forth particulars, and we don't think the complaint does. Not particulars, but allegations, and we don't think it does.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Unit holders signing up to this limited partnership agreement would have understood that when they had special approval as a mechanism for cleansing conflicts, they were going to be relying on independent business people with knowledge to review a transaction and determine its fairness. And that is not what we had here, according to the complaint. We had a passive lay-down process where there was no serious bargaining occurring, and that is not what any reasonable reader of this contract would have assumed they were getting from the members of the conflicts committee. And that is ultimately where the case begins and ends, I submit, that what we have here is a sham process based on the objective facts, and plaintiff absolutely should have the opportunity to obtain discovery, find out what was in fact in these conflicts committee members' minds, but also evaluate the process, how they chose just a 4% bump that was in fact a lower dollar value again than the opening, and decided that it was in fact in the best interest of the partnership to accept a deal that impaired both the value of the units and the size of the distributions received by these investors.
Was it conceded by your side that they ended up in a range of fair value?
It is true that the financial advisor ultimately opined as to fairness based on the facts and certain assumptions, which may or may not be true and are certainly pled in detail in the complaint not to be true. So I'm not sure that a range of value, Your Honor, was specified here. But this court has also never held that because a financial advisor issues an opinion, that that resolves the question of whether a value is in fact fair and reasonable or subject to entire fairness in the corporate context. And even if there were a range of value and the number here were in that range, nonetheless, the gravamen of the complaint is that if this conflicts committee had done its job and bargained in good faith, it would have gotten a better number than this 4% increase. And that is not answered at all by any opinion here by Jefferies.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and assess.